Hi, everyone, and welcome to The Week Ahead. I'm Tony Nash. Today, we're joined by Albert Marco, Vince Lancy, and Blake Morrow. Well, we've got a few key themes. The first one, when I went out to ask about this show, the first response I got back from Twitter was, what the hell happened in China this week? So that's the first thing we're going to cover. The second is, why was silver rallying this week? We're going to talk to Vince about silver and gold. And then with Blake, we'll talk about the Fed and the QRA. CI Markets has been recognized as one of the top stock forecasting tools for 2024 by Techopedia, a leading tech authority. Why? Because it predicts future price movements with a 94.7% accuracy rate. It covers over 1,600 assets with weekly reforecasts of stocks, ETFs, currencies, commodities, and major equity indices. It has an easy-to-use interface optimized for web and mobile, and pricing plans to fit your needs, including a free option. Stop playing guessing games with your investments. Take control of your portfolio with CI Markets. Learn more about CI Markets today at completeintel.com/markets. Let's get right into it. Albert, we're playing kind of the Where's Albert this week. So I like your background. That looks really good. And I think you're a great guy to answer the question, what the hell happened in China this week? So we had a pretty big turnaround in China in the equity markets. We've got a chart for Shanghai Composite on the screen. Of course, the Hang Seng did even better than the Shanghai Composite. The central government just talked about putting a few hundred billion dollars into the markets. They didn't actually do it. They greenlit corporate share buybacks to prop up markets. They reduced the RRR, the reserve requirement, so banks can push more cash out into the economy. And of course, we saw that pretty dramatic turnaround in equity markets. So all of this got markets back to where they were about 2 weeks ago. CNY gained a little bit. It's off. Blake, maybe you can talk through some of those dynamics. But, you know, the question is this: what does this all mean? What did they do right, Albert? And what do you think they should have done that they didn't do?
Oh, what could they should have done is a different animal absolutely altogether. But what was happening was the narrative was just becoming overwhelming for the Chinese economy of, you know, systemic collapse of, you know, the Chinese system from top to bottom, and they had to step in and guarantee. Well, I mean, I know that they haven't done it yet, but close to $300 billion is probably going to be levered up to 5 to 10 times that, to prop up the economy. And their entire gambit was to just change the narrative. You know, they didn't want those headlines that China was collapsing. They're going to have to step in. They did step. Well, they're for sure they're going to step in. There's no question about that. And it was all to prop up the Hong Kong markets. Really, they didn't really care about Shanghai, the mainland, or whatnot. But this was specifically to prop up the Hang Seng.
Okay, so you know, we've seen all these over the past probably 6 months. We've seen all these year-on-year comparisons. You know, X is up, you know, triple digits in China for, you know, trade, or double digits or whatever year-on-year. And, you know, everyone knows the year before things were closed. And, you know, these year-on-year things in China haven't really mattered all that much because they were closed for a year and a half or whatever. So I think what I'm seeing in things like global trade, the trade numbers actually don't look bad. But things in China, we're seeing deflation, we're seeing really a lot of bad news. Politically, things are kind of sketchy. They've had two of their central committee members just kind of disappear over the last 6 months. So can money injected, I'm saying that diplomatically, Vince, can money being injected into markets solve that uncertainty? Or is this just kind of a first step? Like, have they just started and there's a long-term plan? Because we've been hearing about Chinese stimulus for 3 years now, and this is really the first, aside from some kind of stupid rail investment or whatever, this is really the first tranche of cash that we've seen.
Well, I mean, politically, Xi is taking advantage of the situation right now of getting rid of his opposition party members that, you know, are causing him issues or potentially going to cause him issues. I mean, that's what anyone really in leadership would do to take advantage, you know, in this type of scenario. Yellen has her foot on their throats at the moment, and she's been hitting the sell button on China and keeping the dollar elevated, and, you know, rates being up close to, you know, 6% is, you know, the almost the abyss for the Chinese market. So they're definitely playing the defensive. They're trying to prop up the CNY. They're trying to prop up the economy. They're, is it enough? No, absolutely not enough. They're absolutely going to have to keep going on for the next, 4 to 5 years. This is not going to be a 1 year pop and it's going to fix everything. This is going to be 5 years down the road of them doing, multiple staggered steps of stimulus to get the economy back in order.
Yeah, I mean, if we want to make an analogy to the US, imagine if the Secretary of State just literally disappeared 5 months ago. And imagine if the Defense Secretary just literally disappeared, right? And all of a sudden there's some new junior person in their place, right? And so the political uncertainty in China is huge. We saw massive shifts in Chinese money into Japanese and US ETFs over the past 2 weeks, right? And so the Chinese investment itself is not showing support for the Chinese markets. I was in China in June of 2015 when markets fell apart. And at that point, Chinese mainlanders were encouraged by the government to put their money back in markets. They did it based on faith in the CCP. I don't see that happening this time.
No, and the outflows from China have propped up the bond market and the US equities. I mean, it's been just absolutely staggering of how much money has left Asia and even Europe and flowed into the United States. And this was all calculated by Janet Yellen. I mean, she knows what she's doing. She's been the Fed chair. She's got her fingers on all the buttons at the Treasury. They know that if China starts taking off, inflation is going to be another problem right now. And I'm sure our guests will talk about silver and commodities because that's a big key part of it. If China is firing on all cylinders, commodities are going to skyrocket again.
Yep. And
Lithium, copper, everything.
Albert, I want to jump in here just because you're talking about commodities. I mean, for the markets that I follow, especially like the Australian dollar, copper, unresponsive to all the actions. And for us traders in the currency space and in the commodity space, we look at it as like a shotgun approach. Yeah, maybe there this might have been, more of a bigger slug, I guess, that came out of this shotgun shot. But still, you can see the muted response that we're getting in commodities, in currencies. And I think you guys draw a really strong correlation, which should definitely be noted between like the Nikkei. The market's definitely shunning China in favor of the Warren Buffett Berkshire Hathaway trade of Japan. Even Germany and a lot of European equities and U.S. equities, they're all beneficiaries. But then again, if we do see China turn the corner a little bit, which I think it's too early to tell, maybe that takes a little bit of the air out of some of the other markets around the globe. So,
Like, can you talk to us a little bit about CNY dynamics? Kind of, it really hasn't moved much.
no, it hasn't. And I don't focus on the CNY as much as my European counterparts do because and my colleagues that traded because as a US-based trader, it's prohibited for a lot of
Oh, yeah,
brokers
ours.
to be involved. But it's a lever that China uses, and one of the other things that if they want to really, kind of kickstart their economy a little bit, they'll weaken the CNH a little bit more. But we are up at dire levels, because as Albert pointed out, this is a more of a confidence, I think, topic. So if you start to see the CNH really come under pressure because the PBOC pulls that lever, next thing you
Right.
know, yeah, it might help the Chinese economy a little bit, but to what extent does it hurt sentiment in equities and sentiment in general? I mean, there has not been a time I can't really recall a time that I've seen a singular market so just shunned upon right now, like you are
Right.
seeing in China right now. So,
Yep.
If can I add
Brilliant.
something to
Go ahead.
that?
Yeah.
The two statements, Blake's comment about the muted effect on commodities as well as the emerging market currencies, commodity currencies, and the comment about them being too safe or well, I guess what I'm trying to say is in the past, when they changed the reserve requirements, I had seen commodity currencies and commodities do better than Chinese stocks. And this time, and you know, it's one data point, but this time Chinese stocks, you know, as low as they are, responded very appropriately, you know, and I'm wondering if the whole lack of buying of commodities compared to stocks this time is not a comment on China saying, what China's leadership saying, you know, we need people to buy stocks and stop buying, you know, pet rocks like gold. So anyway, I think the lack of confidence in China's economy has been one of the reasons they've been buying gold at the retail level anyway, or at the individual level. Yep. And they need to change that, or they're going to have a deflationary crisis.
Yep.
And I just think both those things are.
Those are all great points, Vince. I think the Hang Seng was up between 4 and 5% this week. It's still down like 20% over the last 6 months. Shanghai Composite was up 2 point something this week. So, you know, we've seen a turnaround, but we haven't seen a dramatic turnaround, right? We haven't seen a 15%. You know, it's not as if they've kind of backed up the truck, put in trillions of dollars. You know, I think they're being very careful fiscally, because they do have to balance a huge amount of government debt that China has. And they're very careful not to print right away. But my worry is, and if we look at the triple R, Vince, you know, they've made a triple R move. Is that beginning, middle, and like, what, you know, where do you guys think we are on that?
Well, I mean, going back to what Blake said, we are only in stage one of a long game here of what China has to do to get back on track. It's going to be years on down the road until anything meaningful really happens with the Chinese economy. Of course, we're going to get stock market pops up and down, because that's just the nature of the stock market globally at the moment. I mean, normally you would see, like Vincent said, commodities would just rip, you know, on any kind of Chinese news. But that's just not the case anymore. So, I mean, it's going to be a nuanced approach from this point on.
Maybe if we stop buying Chinese-made laundry furniture, patio furniture, they'll stop buying commodities to make them. Maybe that's what's going on right now.
Could be. I think it's really interesting this week. We've seen so many Asia equity analysts say, hey, China's a huge value right now. You need to get in. And nobody's buying it. I don't know if anybody's buying it, but I don't see.
Well, no, there are, Tony. There are big funds buying it clandestinely at the moment. They're starting to get in, because, I mean, honestly, if you look at a systemic collapse of China, they're not going to let that happen. And neither the U.S. nor China will allow that to happen. So at some point, it's a decent play long term to get into China. Long term. I'm not saying, you know, next 6 months, but, you know, next 2, 3, 4 years, absolutely. You know, you would be wise to put a position on.
Yeah, my biggest worry here has been that $278 billion, the market looks at it and shrugs. And that's kind of what we've seen, right? And the problem with filling holes in markets is that if you don't put enough in, they just get bigger and bigger and bigger and hungrier and hungrier. So is there a danger of that, of we open next week and markets just kind of yawn at the $278 billion and all of a sudden China has to scurry to put out a bigger number sooner?
Well, I think we have to wait until the actual mechanism of what China is going to use to do that. I know they're going to be using offshore funds and accounts and lever it up. So we really have to wait until the data comes out, because I assure you it's not going to be just $278 billion. It'll probably be in the trillion, over the trillion range.
And I also read, and correct me if I'm wrong, if you heard something different, that there's a lot of calls being made to institutional, you know, Chinese institutional clients that, like, stop shorting the market, you know, only be on the long side, you know, kind of throwing those warnings out, which is, I find, really interesting. But, you know, the sentiment is interesting, and it is, and I've always found it, you know, my quarter century of trading the markets, a very interesting dynamic in the markets, because sentiment, you could almost use the analogy, it's like inflation, it's that genie that you can't get back in the bottle. Sentiment, when it's sour, it's sour. It takes a lot to turn. And you know, you could look at the polar opposite of the US economy right now and the optimism that, you know, people feel, and regulators understand what that is. And I think Xi has a very good understanding of that sentiment and why he's trying to turn it. So.
Great. Okay. Hey, I'd like to make sure you know that you can access our AI-driven market forecasting tool called CI Markets for free. no strings attached, and it does not require any credit card information. Go to completeintel.com/markets to subscribe. CI Markets is the perfect addition to your analysis toolbox. This free account includes Nikkei stocks, major currency pairs, and global economics. Of course, we offer much more in our paid account, but this lets you experience CI Markets before making a financial commitment. CI Markets uses the power of AI to help you make better trading investment decisions. It's absolutely free. Again, go to completeintel.com/markets to subscribe to CI Markets free. Let's move on to precious metals. Vince, you put out a piece earlier this week on silver. Okay. On Tuesday, you're talking about why you bought silver this week. I know it's retreated as we've headed into the end of the week, but I've got a gold silver chart on screen. A lot of this has to do with China, which is really interesting to me. Can you talk us through why you got in, what levels you looked for, and what are you looking for going forward?
Sure. I'm happy to do that. The first of all, it's a short-term trade. It's not a macro trade. It was more like a, you know, win for one day, win for a week, and then just keep running with it if it continues to win. And stopped winning yesterday, as far as I was concerned. But we'll get to that. The thing with silver and gold is they've completely diverged in the public eye. Looking at the China demand for gold, looking at the BRICS demand for gold, looking at the using gold as an alternative to the treasury, or maybe a little bit of a hedge for the treasury as a reserve asset, that increase, well, that's kind of left silver in the dust. That's the first leg, right? Silver's not precious enough, you know? And, you know, it takes a lot more space to store it if you are having to deal with something like that. And so that's one leg that gets kicked out on silver. And this is all going to lead to why I bought it, actually. And the second leg that gets kicked out on silver is very flow-oriented. You know, the last 10, 15 years of behavior in precious metals have been silver isn't good for anything. And you know, as a silver bug, I have to see what the enemy says. But the reality of it is if you're pitching an investment or a trade, right? If you're saying risk off, you buy gold, if you're looking at metals, right? If you say risk on, you buy copper because it's an economic metal, right? And this is manifested out of China as well for years. Every time they throw a little stimulus out there, it's like buy steel, buy iron, buy copper, and then eventually you buy silver. So that's the pecking order in precious metals on the economic side.
I've never heard it put that way. That's great. Thank you for that. I've never heard it put that way. That's
cool. Thank you. That's how I used to trade it, because I would whatever. Copper's up, I'll buy silver for storing Asia. If copper was up during the U.S., I would sell silver. It was, you know, it's like a time trade. But bringing it back to why I actually bought silver is the commodity trading advisors, the CTAs, they tend to move in groups, you know, like a herd. And they frequently lose money on short-term moves. And when they make money, it's on big-term moves, long-term moves. And they would, I would call them momentum. Most of them are momentum traders. And they sell weakness and they buy strength. And right about the time people started talking about recession, your commodity trading advisors in the US started putting their clients into shorting oil, shorting silver, shorting copper, and shorting aluminum, those that did trade aluminum. And they do that. It's, you know, it's kind of interesting because it's so facile, but it works. Instead of selling their stocks, they hedge the economic exposure by selling commodities. And oil trended lower. They made money. Silver trended lower despite gold's strength coming out of China. Silver, you know, was constantly beat upon. And copper trended lower despite, you know, calls for, you know, a super cycle and what have you, which will come eventually, just not when we're looking at it. Mm-hmm. So when the markets get thin or when there's not a lot going on, now you have, you know, a big cohort of shorts in silver and oil, right? I'll put silver, oil, and gold in this triangle here, right? So everyone at the CTA level, whether it be small managed money or medium-sized managed money, is looking at gold, having been shorted twice and gotten killed in a little bit of a short covering rally when the Ukraine war started, and then getting killed when the Middle East, the Hamas-Israel war started. they're staying away from it, or they're long, right? So that's their hedge, right? Meanwhile, they're going, well, you know, silver, I think I'll short that. So they'll short that as well economically. And when there's nothing going on and people start talking about the Fed easing or the Fed cuts, you know, stocks go up and silver stops going down, oil stops going down, copper stops going down. Yep. And then one day you just see all those commodities have like a little bit of a V-shaped bottom. Oil, silver. Well, oil wasn't V-shaped. Oil, silver, and the grains. Gold is nowhere, right? And they start to move up. And at that moment, I know, you know, from historical perspective and from analysis that I look at, that the CTAs, which are the first to move, right? They're the first to move. They're buying silver. They're buying oil. They're buying copper. They're buying grains. And they're probably selling gold. Closing the whole thing out. And for 3 days, that worked out very nicely. And then, you know, the market paused today. So that's why I bought it, right? That's why I bought it. I thought, okay, maybe the Fed's going to ease. I'm long stocks. I'll buy silver. I kind of did the opposite of what they do. And it worked for a couple of days. And then it just kind of flatlined on the flows that I saw. And I said, okay, CTAs have covered, but they don't have any money to put into it. And there's, you know, we talk about markets that climb walls of worry, you know, gold is up, stocks up, you know, over the last 3 years. And there's just no, like, there's so much money on the sidelines in stocks, and yet stocks are up. And then you look at gold, it's like, well, the macro investor speculators, they don't even care about gold anymore. And yet gold is up. And there's such a lack of participation in silver on the American side. Mm. Except for, you know, all the lunatics that think silver's going to go to the moon tomorrow, which, you know, they're friends of mine, so I'm going to defend them. and I'm probably one of them, you know, but I try and keep a lid on it for times like this. Nobody buys silver on the follow through. So I got out of my longs today, and I actually shorted a little bit of gold because I think China is going to get filled, you know, on their buying underneath. So that's it. I think in the short term, it could continue to go higher, but it won't be because of what I saw. I wouldn't know what drives it higher. In the longer term, I think if stocks drop, silver gets hit more. If stocks drop, gold gets hit. If stocks drop, oil should get hit, but oil's its own animal right now, it seems. You know, it's got its own thing going on. So longer term, I'm very constructive on silver, but that was a trade that just came and went. You know,
you're just looking for the catalyst, right?
I'm sorry,
we're looking for the long-term catalyst. So Vince, you sent me a Goldman chart. Can you walk us through this? You've already covered some of this, but can you walk us through this this Goldman chart? And then can you walk us through what some of the catalysts might be? And I'm also curious, what happens if we don't see a rate cut in March?
Okay, so the chart that you're putting up there, I think it's basically a graphic depiction of what I described, and it confirmed what I had thought. The chart describes several things, but it's basically a year of performance, and the dark blue part of the body, forget those, the wicks above and wicks below, I forget what they're called, but the dark blue body represents how long, that's if you go up on the chart, and how short investors get in these assets. And if you look on the left, you see oil there. And what we're focused on for this conversation is this green star. The green star shows you that, generally speaking, of all the money that investors, that CTA investors, these are small and medium sized at best, this is a sentiment indicator, actually. You know, when you think about what Blake was talking about, this is a sentiment indicator. The oil people had been extremely bearish and short, you know, out the wazoo. Conversely, if you go to the right side of the chart, you'll see that they're also long gold, and that's because of the war or what have you, SVB Bank or whatever the reason. And then you look at silver and you say, look at silver. Silver on the far right is they're extremely short based on how that star is positioned. And silver is behaving in the minds of the normal person. Silver is like copper, you know, it's behaving like copper. So
when they diverge like that, how long do they usually diverge like that, gold and silver?
They can diverge like that for for months. Okay. I think, and that'll happen when the market is dominated by Fed behavior, right? And so if we're just talking about domestic politics and rates and Fed stuff and everything is fine in a neo-Keynesian world, well, then you're going to see buy gold, sell silver, buy gold, sell silver. And they won't even buy that much gold. They'll just happily sell silver, you know, because every time they're buying stock, they're raising capital using something else. But when there's a global geopolitical problem, doesn't have to be a war. You had the like Brexit was an example of one. Grexit was another one. More recently, the English, the gilt, when they had the problem there with that mini budget. Right. I forget what the actual, but anyway, what ends up happening is everyone's long gold and short silver, and they're just happy. And then one day they wake up and silver's 50 cents higher, you know, and they say, oh, you know, maybe we should cover that. And so then they cover it. And so basically when the market is focused on American economics, that will stay stretched for a long period of time. But when an event happens, like the Ukraine war, for example, they all bought gold and they all sold silver at that moment. And then a month later, gold kept going up. So they ended up buying silver. So those are your
interesting
domestic versus geopolitical. That's what changes the ads.
Hey, Vance, I don't have a lot. I mean, aside from being owning, I come from the camp. I don't like shorting precious metals. I like to own precious metals, like physical.
Right.
So I try not to trade them on the short side. If I'm going to trade them, I like to be on the long side. But why? Just because, you know, I have my technical views, and I actually think silver is going lower. Just to throwing that out there. Sorry, yeah. I know it's, you know, I might be your enemy.
I trade both sides.
But why did silver outpace gold so excessively during like the COVID lockdowns?
Yeah. Well, during the COVID lockdowns, that was a special situation. And the situation,
you can say that again.
No, right, exactly. No, but actually it's directly COVID related. I mean, you're basically right. This is kind of bizarre. And as a physical person, I think you'd appreciate this. There was an artificial problem, and it manifested more in silver than in gold then. Here's what happens. Actually, it's a nice little story. The late George Giro and I were talking about this. During COVID, a lot of the flows in the U.S. are, if you want to buy metal on the COMEX, let's say you're going to take delivery on the COMEX, right? If you're going to take delivery on the COMEX, what really happens is you buy it on the COMEX, the bullion bank does an ARB, an EFP ARB, right? And they buy it on the COMEX, and they end up taking delivery in London. They send it to a refiner to change it to COMEX specs, and boom, it comes over here. And if you're the U.S. Mint, that's what you're doing. You have to buy domestic, so you buy COMEX, and the bullion banks are just like, they're doing their ARB, their little EFP, and then the London bullion market gives them the metal. They refine it there, and then it comes back here. I don't know, it's blanks or, you know, whatever, even Spider-Man coins, who the heck knows, right? But that's what happens. During COVID, and it happened for both sides, meaning gold as well as silver, during COVID, and I actually watched this, like I actually had it on a map of it, most of the refiners, most of the, there's other words, smelters or what have you, they're in northern Italy and Switzerland. And so during that time frame in the Lombardy region of Italy, Lombardy was hit ridiculously hard during COVID. They shut them down. So the coins, and here's like, it's classic. It was, you know what it was? It was regulatory arbitrage. You can see this, right? All right. So you had these specs. I'll use the gold one because it's easier to understand. The gold bar in London is 300 ounces. The gold bar in the US is 100 ounces. They were not fungible. You couldn't take, right? So during that time, you take the 300-ounce bar, you take it over to northern Italy, you have it broken into three 100-ounce bars, and you send it over. They were all shut. So for a very short time frame, and you're a trader, so you're gonna appreciate this. For a very short time frame in the US, we had a venue short squeeze. So everyone wanted COMEX gold and COMEX silver, preferably silver. Why would they not take London? Because of the regulatory differences. And for a time frame, you could not take delivery of London silver and London gold in the US. And they fixed that by creating a swap contract. But for a time frame, you had deep backwardation in the COMEX, you know, front month to 1 year out, you know, 5% spread. And then you had spot in London trading below because there was no one working. So that's what happened then.
Interesting.
That's, yeah, and of course the whole kicker about the economics, you know, the money going into the hot, but that's what happened. And in fact, if you look back at history, I mean, if you look back at history, it was just fascinating because I was like, oh, look at that backwardation on the COMEX. Silver and gold must be in the moon in London. Where is it? Like, plenty of silver here. Well, why don't you send it over there? Can't do that. You guys won't take it anyway. So. That's what happened then.
Oh, thanks. That's interesting to know. I know my partner, one of my partners at Forex Analytics was all over silver around $15, just buying the living bejesus out of it. Yeah. And I was like, huh. Yeah. Anyway. Okay. Great. Great to know. Yeah. Thank you.
I mean, that was the kicker. He was right for a different reason, I'm sure.
Yeah.
That was the kicker. You know, look, the silver market is a broken market. I'm going to say this about paper. And I'm not even going to get into the paranoid, you know, conspiracy stuff. What I mean is the contract is so big that, you can't buy a fifth of a contract. There's no one who trades the micro. And so you accumulate and then you've got a problem. It's made for producers. Speculators are, you know, hung out to dry very frequently there.
Got it.
That's great. Okay. A lot of detail there.
Sorry about that.
Rewatch this to digest.
My first time. I had caffeine. I'm trying to. I want to be asked back, and so you can say, Vince, you're really cool. Thanks for coming back.
of course. Speaking of being out, Scott Blake, I'm always impressed when someone as respectable as you comes back on our program. So, thanks for making your performance. I really appreciate that.
Thanks for having me, and I appreciate the comments. Thank you.
You told me that you're watching Fed and QRA next week. And yeah. I think we're all watching Fed and QRA next week. We saw Christine Lagarde speak this week at the ECB. They're holding rates. I think there's an expected cut in April or something, right? So Europe is a mess. I'm not really sure. I really trust what they say, but I think they're trying to do all they can to manage their market. So Europe is Q2 in terms of a cut. Are you looking for similar messaging from the Fed next week?
I'm not actually. And you know, I think the Fed, well, first of all, I have to take a step back and say, what does the Fed have to gain by doing that? The Fed, and you take like Chairman Powell, he's really good at telegraphing and giving the market what it wants too. So that's a whole another animal. But I've talked a lot with a lot of different macro analysts about, you know, financial conditions and financial conditions have eased quite a bit for a lot of the United States and a lot of businesses, a lot of individuals and you could actually even see the pending home sales today was just bonkers, right? So the problem that you're going to have if you're the Fed is that you have to make sure you cap those expectations a little bit, or the function of getting inflation sustainably below their 2% target is going to be a little bit more difficult. So I think the Fed if I was the Fed chair, I'd have to push back a little bit on expectations just to keep the market from getting too frothy. And a lot of people might say that stocks are frothy right now. I mean, we are at all-time highs and you can't ignore the fact where we're at right now. And there is a thing called trickle-down effect. And, you know, yes, the top 10% or 5% of Americans own the majority of the stock market. And but if I feel wealthier, I'm going to spend more at this restaurant and it's going to trickle down. And there is something to that, and it does ease conditions a bit. So I think the Fed's got to walk a fine line. I don't think they're going to give us a whole lot. I think the bigger deal is going to be the quarterly refinance announcement or quarterly requirement announcement, QRA, the acronyms, and it's late in the week for me. The QRA is going to be more of the kicker that happens actually the morning of the FOMC. And the markets, they got a bit of a gift. I was talking to one of my They got a bit of a gift this last quarterly announcement in November. That on top of the Fed, on top of Waller, who became a little bit more dovish. Now, if you you know, think about where we're at right now. And I was talking to one of my colleagues, a gentleman by the name of K-Man. He made a great point that Janet Yellen was just, you know, on the wires yesterday. She sounded pretty upbeat. She's the lever puller, if you will. Yeah. And, you know, she could very easily, you know, tweak the QRA a bit because she's feeling a little bit better about where we're at. I don't know if that's necessarily going to be the case, but that's going to be something that I think is going to be closely watched, you know, from that allocation of notes and you know, going back over to bonds. And I don't know if there's going to be a change there, but I think the whole market is very queued up into it. And with the Fed, there's a lot of risk. If you own stocks at these levels, you have to be nervous about next week. And I think if you own risk in general, one other thing I want to point out is the dollar is holding up exceptionally well in this current environment.
Yep.
So with that being said, you know, I think currency traders, myself included, and I happen to have both short and long dollar exposure at the moment, but more long dollar exposure at the moment on balance. I think if you're short dollars, you're going into next week a little nervous. And I think that the Fed and the QRA is going to have a lot to do with what happens not only in the currency market, but what happens in yields and what happens ultimately in equities as well.
Yeah, so, I want to dig into that a little bit. First, let's step back to the Fed for a minute.
Yeah.
Seems to me that you think that the Fed rates are going to be pushed, or the rate cuts are going to be pushed back further than people think. So, you know, Vince said, you know, if you don't have a March rate cut, it could, you know, impact markets. Seems like you're thinking the Fed's going to cut after the ECB, first thing. And
yeah,
but tell me where I'm wrong on that. And second,
you're not
the QT. Are they going to ease off QT? Are we going to see it accelerate, stay at the same rate? We're not going to hear about it anymore. What's going to happen there?
I don't think I don't see why they would change the rate of QT right now. Why? Because it's, you know, the market's not broken at the moment. So why change the pace of that? But as far as rates go, like as far as expectations go, I think what we're going to see next week is we're going to see a little bit of a shift. The market has been pretty, you know, I mean, it's been the talk of the markets for the last couple of months, and about market expectations versus, you know, what the Fed thinks. I think they have to bring those expectations down a little bit. But what I have to also add is equity markets and, you know, risk in general, you can call it, has been very, you know, nonchalant about adjusting their expectations, regardless of what the Fed says. So, I looking at the U.S. economy and a lot of the talk about soft landing, I mean, how is the Fed supposed to, you know, allow expectations to continue to be inflated like this for a rate cut in this current environment without making financial conditions even looser and making their job a little bit more difficult?
PCE came in above expectations. Housing came in above expectations. Markets are rallying. Why do you need a cut right now? I just don't understand why we keep hearing about cuts if all of this stuff is happening.
Well, because people think that the trajectory is going in the direction where inflation will eventually be below 2%. It kind of, I look at they've taken their revolver. I use a gun analogy. They've taken their revolver and they expended all their bullets, you know, years ago, bringing rates down to zero. They've currently loaded their whole chamber up now, and they could expend a couple of bullets, maybe prematurely, you know, preventatively, if you will, because they're looking into what's going to happen, what potentially could happen in 2024, 2025. That would be the argument. I don't know if I necessarily buy that argument. That's why I think the Fed's going to be fairly reserved in doing that. And you know, I like to use analogies quite a bit. When you're you know, running a marathon, and I've used this over the last, you know, 6-8 months, you're running a marathon and you're trying to get to the very end of the marathon. Your last mile or two is going to be the most difficult. And that's the fight against inflation. Naturally, it was coming down. Naturally, as we approach that 2% target, it's going to be a little bit more difficult for the Fed. They're not going to help themselves any further by not putting a cap on interest rate cut expectations, in my opinion. So
right, okay. Yeah. And speaking of rates, as we look at the QRA, I've got marketable treasury debt on the screen. What do you expect? I mean, I expect going into an election year, Yellen is just going to expand. Her comments on Thursday seem to indicate, we're going to have a lot of fiscal this year to aid the administration. How aggressive do you think the forward look is with that QRA?
Well, first of all, I don't want to just give you answers just to give you answers. I'm not one that's going to follow all the debt issuance, but I will tell you that as far as I know, and everybody else will tell you probably in the comments down below, there's a lot of issuance coming forward. Mm-hmm. There is. Now the QRA is going to be the, what that balance looks like.
And wait, I'm sorry. Can I ask a question just to clarify? Yeah, so we don't have to go back. When you say coming forward, do you mean it's coming up or coming up, moving it forward on the yield curve? Okay.
No, it's like all the issuance that's coming out. I mean,
Right.
Yeah. Okay. New issuance is coming out. Okay. So as a result, we have to keep in mind that it is coming, and you're right. It's going to continue to expand. What the ratio is what the market's going to be focused more on. So like I said, I'm not a bond expert, but I do understand the fact that the Fed continues to, auction off, long-term maturities, and the take-up's been good. Bond auctions have been pretty strong, despite a lot of people thinking they won't be. So
I have a question about the Fed. Can we circle back to that 1 second?
Sure, absolutely.
Tony, or should I just wait a little bit?
Go for it.
I feel like the market, this is a question I don't have an answer to, so it's not rhetorical in any way.
Yeah.
When he seemed to come out as very dovish that first moment, a couple months ago, when stocks started to take it, the market interpreted that. The initial comment was, everyone's got a narrative in the story, was he doesn't want to be seen as impeding Biden, it's an election year. And I personally don't think they're easing in March. Okay. So that's I thought QT would maybe taper off, but that's my bias. No easing. QT might taper off. That's what I thought. But when he did that and the markets really rallied and they started coming out, Fed speakers started coming out talking a little bit tougher, slowed it down a little bit. I couldn't help but wonder your comment was essentially he's walking a line, the last mile or so are hard. And, he's trying to let the animal spirits out without letting them rush out too hard. But how would this be different if we didn't have an election year, if it would be different at all? I feel like is he doing anything to make sure he doesn't appear biased in any way, shape or form?
Is Jay Powell political? I'm going to tell you this much. If I was Jay Powell, I wouldn't want to face who I think I'm going to be facing coming up in about, 9 months. So he's dealt with, President Trump before. He's probably going to be dealing with him again. And I have to imagine that, I would assume, and again, assumption, that the Biden administration is not as forceful with Jay Powell as a Trump administration would be. So do I think I think he's actually genuinely trying to do what's best for the people as a whole.
I don't mean that. I wasn't being conspiratorial at all. I think so as well. I mean, I'm just trying to figure out, if there were an election, would he not have talked nice before he got tough? I mean, look, I'm kind of threading needles here. I'm just kind of feeling like the market was so adamant for him to ease that if he didn't say something like that, it would have been like he was hurting Biden. And we don't think he wants to hurt Biden, of course. But I'm just looking at it like it just seemed like such a departure for him after having gotten through SVB, SNB, and all these other problems for him to just say, we might ease rates when really inflation isn't under 2% yet. The 6-month outlook trajectory is definitely under 2%. But, why would he do that? That's what I understand.
Yeah, I don't know. And I think, so when you're talking about inflation, first of all, why he came out the way, you know, as dovish as he was, it was a bit of a head scratcher for us, you know, as trading the markets.
Rare tactical error, I thought.
You know. Yeah. And the other thing is, like, you know, I hear all these, you know, debates, you know, especially in the mainstream financial media, you know, if you're listening to Bloomberg or CNBC, and, you know, they talk about people on the street that they don't feel like inflation's under control either. That's because the average person doesn't understand inflation. People don't understand that, you know, they think prices go up, they come back down, but people don't understand that prices go up and they stay up. You know, inflation is the rate that prices are going higher versus, you know, you know, everybody's like, oh, you know, my cost of my bread is has gone up to, you know, whatever it is, you know, $4 a loaf versus $3 a loaf. So it's eventually going to come back down to three. And that would be, you know, inflation's coming down, but that's actually deflation. And that's something that's very rarely seen. So the problem that we are dealing with at this moment with inflation is people have these unrealistic expectations as, you know, the Americans just in general, because we've never dealt with inflation for the majority of Americans. You can talk to anybody who's 65 and older and they understand what real inflation is. But for us that are under the age of 60, which I'm in my 50s, you know, we don't know what it's like. And most Americans don't know what it's like. So I think
I'm going to push back a little bit on that. I mean, we've had average 24% inflation since pre-COVID. So, you know, I think people do, I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm saying I really do think people do understand it, you know, things hurting their pocketbook, right?
No, I agree with that.
Germany 1920, of course.
But the disconnect is when prices don't come down, right? That's going to be the disconnect. And I think that's what's going to eventually bite the U.S. consumer. Sentiment in general is going to be when prices don't come down over a long period of time. And you know, and then you have the Fed that can't reach that 2% inflation goal, and then rates aren't coming down, and then consumer sentiment starts to turn sour. That's where it all feeds together. And I think that hits somewhere in this 2024 year.
Actually. No, I've never understood about the inflation discussion is gasoline prices go up and they go down. They go up and they go down. We never really hear about deflation in gasoline prices.
No.
And so, you know, I hear these deflationary arguments, and what that means to me ultimately is that corporate profits collapse, right? And as corporate profits collapse, wages are pulled back and other things. Right. So yeah, there is that follow on effect, but we have something that all of us buy every week, unless you're on public transport in some big city or whatever. And there's deflation in gasoline all the time. And it's never really, I mean, this stupid discussion about gas prices falling is like a tax cut, which is ridiculous. But we never really hear people saying, oh, there's deflation in gasoline.
No, they don't. Because it's the ultimate variable that's moving around so quickly for most people, not even Americans. This is like globally consumers, you know,
right?
No matter where their benchmark is for what gas prices are, it's the one that makes you feel better, right? If I was just spending $100 to fill my gas tank and now I'm spending 65, that's a huge savings to me.
It's a tax cut.
Yeah, it's a tax cut. There you go. Right. But, and that's why, you know, you get, for a lot of people to bet against, you know, prices coming down, you know, during an election year, it's a tough bet. It's a tough trade, right? Because, yep, you know, if you're a politician and you're the Biden administration, yeah, you want prices to come down because you want people to say, hey, prices have come down, I feel better, I'll vote for you again. You know, that
your July 4th barbecue is 14 cents cheaper.
Right. Exactly. You know, it's crazy. But I think is going to be a big shock for not just Americans. I think, you know, the global consumer is that prices for most things, they've risen and then they'll stay higher. And, you know, if you look back in history and you go back to, you know, way back in the 50s, I could buy this for 5 cents and now it's, you know, 80 cents. Well, there's a reason for that.
You make a whole lot more money now, right?
Yeah.
You're old. That's the reason.
Yeah, that's right. That's the reason.
And we're old. That's
okay, others. Guys. So we have a lot to look forward. I think what you're saying with Fed and Treasury, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but we're kind of at a point of uncertainty, right? There are a lot of expectations in the market, but it doesn't necessarily look like there's the catalyst to change things one way or the other. Is that in general a takeaway from what you're saying?
Well, I'll just add this, and I'm sure Vince wants to chime in here. This is a very pivotal week for the market, and I think people underestimate the gravity of how big this next week is for the markets in general. Whether you're talking about risk markets, stocks, China, monetary policy expectations, the dollar. Precious metals, as Vince has been alluding to, this is going to be a very pivotal week for the markets, and this is not one to sleep on. This is not one where you're going to go rearrange your sock drawer. You want to be in front of your computers, managing what you trade. So
that's right, exactly. Vince, any closing thoughts on the week coming up?
Well, I don't have anything to add to that. That's pretty much it. You have a lot of events converging in March, I think Fed policy. Fed's in a reactive situation, I believe, right now. So, So they may want to or not want to ease. They may want to or not want to taper QT, but they need to wait. Now, the data has been kind of choppy. This week was strong, but the data in general has been up and down. So maybe they're just going to stay the course until they get a distinct trend in the economy weakening with the inflation weaker.
Yeah. And I think staying the course is going to disappoint a lot of people.
You know, and I forgot to mention this, and it, just bringing it up. One thing that we have to also keep in mind, the FOMC is an open market committee. It's a committee where he's looking for a unanimous, decision one way or the other. And you know, going back to Vince, you asked about the Fed and why the Fed chair was so dovish. Lot of that thought back then, and I'm just thinking about it now, but I wanted to throw this in there, is because he wanted to appease a lot of the doves that were in the FOMC. I think he's done that. And I think the market has responded to it, obviously, in retrospect. Now, he's going to have to rein that in a little bit and be a little bit more hard stance and maybe a little bit more hawkish.
So it helps. See, now I didn't think of it that way. So it helps to think of Powell as representing the committee.
Yes.
He may disagree with the committee, but he's got to represent the committee.
Yes, exactly.
Now behind closed doors, he's probably saying, told you. No,
are you freaking crazy? I mean, right, exactly. He's probably doing a lot of that. And I'm sure, and remember, when we get the FOMC meeting minutes, they do give us what we want to hear or what they think the market wants to hear, not necessarily what you-
Highly edited, heavily edited, yeah. Guys, thank you so much. This has been really, really informative. I really appreciate your time, all your thoughts, and I just hope you have a great weekend and a great week ahead. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you. Have a good weekend.
Thank you.